All right. So anyway, thanks for the invitation, and it's a pleasure to be here. I was here a couple of years ago, I believe. Luis invited me to come, and I gave a preliminary version of this, and I left pending some questions that hopefully today I'll be able to provide a more definitive answer for. So the topic is basically for those of you who were here before, or those who have seen parts of this talk before, like Gil here and Luis, of course, sort of a follow-up from that. But I'll start, you know, for those of you who are not super familiar with this topic, with a brief introduction, you know, just to set the stage and to let you know the few basic things you need to remember as we go along to make sense of more detailed applications of these ideas. Okay, so, and I like to call this the alleged small-scale promise of Lambda CDN because I used that word in a CIFAR meeting a few months ago, and Joe Silk picked up on it and said, "Alleged, you are reading Trump's literature or something." Apparently, I was like, you know. So anyway, I like that. So good to get some reaction. So I'll keep that. Anyways, the idea here is to look at cold dark matter. Okay, so we have this established paradigm. At least, you know, have a model. Dark matter is cold. We know its initial conditions. We can measure lots of things from a micro background. And then, best of all, if the universe was just cold dark matter, just with no initial conditions, basically doesn't interact with much, we can put it in a computer and evolve it. Okay? And predict what would be the clustering of cold dark matter basically everywhere in the universe today on all the scales that we care for in terms of extragalactic astronomy. Okay? And this is, you know, been a long quest over the past few decades, but I think now we know quite a bit about this. We know the distribution of dark matter on very, very large scales. We know the topology of the dark matter clustering. We know the statistics of dark matter clustering. We know even the inner structure of these nonlinear objects into which dark matter collapses, these little clumps that you see over here. This is a blow-up of this one. And we learned a few things about that. Actually, we even know the substructure of each of these little clumps. And with actually excellent accuracy and all the statistics that they may care about. So if the universe was just cold dark matter, problem is solved. Right? But unfortunately, we are not cold dark matter. So clearly, we're missing something here. And that's where the part becomes interesting because, of course, the only way to test this is to use observations which are based on things that are not cold dark matter. And that will get to that at the end. Okay, so let me tell you a few things that you should remember here. One is about self-similarity, the similarity of structures where they form in cold dark matter. And this basically, when I think of this in broad terms, as the fact that gravity has no scales, the power spectrum initial density fluctuations have very few scales, especially on scales of galaxies, and therefore everything kind of looks self-similar. And this is one example. This is the dark matter halo. This is the collapsed region of the dark matter. It's the region basically where the crossing time is shorter than the age of the universe. So a dark matter particle can cross this several times in the age of the universe. That's what distinguishes this region from, you know, large-scale structure. This is something like a galaxy. This is something like a big galaxy cluster, 1,000 times more massive than this one. Once you rescale the sizes to the size of it, where the crossing time is the same in both, then they all look the same. Okay? They look the same. They even have the substructure that you see over here, which are the remnants of the accretion process that gave rise to the big object, are actually the same in scaled units. Okay. So that's one thing you want to know. The other thing we want to know is that we understand the inner structure of these things fairly well. And this is just giving one something else. Now, if you were to try to simplify that self-similarity I talked about, and for example, plot the mass profile of this. In other words, how much mass is there within what radius? In other words, this is the density profile. Find the center, look at constructing, you know, spherical shells, measure the density into the shells, and plot that versus radius. So log-log plot, log density. And these are four different halos, just as an example. This is a very old plot for historical reasons more than anything. And what you see is that the four things, although they differ by four or five decades in mass, they look the same once you scale them properly. In other words, if you take this low mass one here, you'll bring it down, and you shift it to the right, it will lie exactly on top of this one. Okay, so that's the similarity we're talking about. You can, you know, describe this kind of shape, which is really not a power law, with some simple functions. Doesn't matter exactly what the function is. But the things that you are important to remember is this one. So dark matter density profiles or mass profiles scaled look all the same. That's interesting because, of course, this means they're so similar, but also means that if you don't scale them, they look different. In other words, these curves don't cross. The curves don't cross, it means they can measure, if you measure the density of dark matter at any radius physically, and you say it's whatever, some number, a physical number, then it tells you what halo you're talking about. This halo is more massive than this one everywhere, basically. So that's an idea we'll use later on. The other idea used a bit later on is that people call this dark matter halo's cuspy, in the sense that if you redo the simulation with higher and higher and higher mass resolution, the inner regions, which get better resolved, because everything gets better resolved, you start climbing up this like line, if you want, and you don't get to any converged results. So higher simulations always give you higher densities. And this you can parameterize this inner region with a power law. And that's where the idea of cusp comes from. And one number you want to remember is the power law of Arthur minus 1 is what some kind of a target value that a lot of these simulations seem to achieve, more or less in the regions of the inner, that correspond to the inner regions of galaxies. Again, that's why it's interesting. Okay. I think I said everything that's important. So those are things you will remember for later. Of course, we don't measure densities directly. Okay, we like to measure densities directly of dark matter. We don't. We measure, kinematic traces in galaxies that tell us something about dark matter distribution. And it's all, what we most often use is the speed at which a gas goes around a galaxy in a disk galaxy. The gas is basically forced almost to go as close as possible to circular orbits. And therefore, if you measure the speed of a gas parcel and its distance to the center, you measure its circular velocity, you can turn that into a mass. Okay, so we use, instead of plotting mass density profiles, we work a lot also using what we call circular velocity profiles. So this is the prediction now for cold dark matter for the circular velocity profiles of halos of different masses. You can see, of course, the other one was self-similar. This is also self-similar. So in other words, you take this one, shift it to the right, and go up, you will match this one exactly. These black lines are all the same shape. All right, so but it's also important, if you measure velocity anywhere, at any radius of a galaxy, you should predict the velocity everywhere. Okay. And that is actually fairly well specified. And I guess I'll get back to that. So the last thing you want to remember is that we will use, because the halo, the mass of a halo is not a particularly well-defined characteristic. I mean, if you have a bigger volume, of course you have more mass. Sometimes we use, or often we use, what we call Vmax, the maximum of these curves. You see, all these curves go up to a maximum and then come down. And that's because of the shape of the mass profile of cold dark matter. So the maximum, you see, is very well defined. So this Vmax is really another measure of the halo mass. Okay, so I'll use Vmax or halo mass indistinctly later on. Okay, last thing. Galaxies form in dark matter halos, and we believe that every dark matter halo more massive than something hosts a galaxy. In other words, we have at least one galaxy per halo, per agglomeration of these clumps of dark matter. Okay. Now we can count galaxies, halos very well. I mean, we've done the simulations as I say, several decades now. We can count these halos very, very well and order them as function of mass or as function of Vmax, it doesn't matter. But order as a function of mass and then count them. Count how many you expect per unit volume. And those numbers depend on, things like the normalization of the power spectrum, the amount of dark matter, the Hubble constant, all those things that we now think have been measured to an accuracy that is much better than what we can achieve for a lot of these measurements that we'll talk about. So in other words, this cold dark matter paradigm is now fixed. You can't change it. So this curve that tells you the number density of halos of a given mass, a function of mass, cannot change anymore. You can change the tiny details. But, once you look here, so how many decades you have over here, all the changes you can think of because you vary the couple constant a bit are basically irrelevant. This model for this kind of observations, at least, is very well set. Now, one galaxy, one halo means that the galaxy mass function, you guess, should look something like this. right? And the answer is no. Okay? The galaxy mass function, or luminosity function turned into a mass, mass of stars now, not mass of dark matter, looks very different. Instead of looking like, you know, there's very, like a power over here that kind of turns over and cuts off, it looks like a very sharp cut off here and a almost very flat faint end. In other words, if you want to make that idea work, that every galaxy goes lives in a halo given mass, the assignment of mass of galaxy to halo must be quite different. It must differ as a function of mass. That assignment should be very nonlinear. Okay? A simple way to think how that assignment might work is by adopting something that people call abundance matching, but it basically just means matching halos to galaxies based on their abundance, their number density, rather than their masses. Okay? This is a measure of the mass, this is the abundance. So these halos, which are this abundant, are the hosts of these galaxies, which have the same abundance. So you match these things horizontally. Okay? And that gives you a prescription for how galaxy mass depends on halo mass if you want to match the luminosity function of the galaxies. Seems ad hoc? It is, but it's useful. It tells you more or less, you know, what kind of assignment between halo mass and galaxy mass you expect. Especially interesting because I will talk about small scales. I won't talk about this, you know, very large. These are clusters of galaxies, dwarf galaxies, very faint galaxies, okay, over here. And you see here, the thing is almost flat. Being flat means that if you do this abundance matching, you look at them horizontally, you see all of these galaxies live basically in the same halos, halos of the same mass. So all dwarfs should, to first order, live in basically the same halo, regardless of their mass. You can change the halo mass, the dwarf galaxy mass, by a factor of 1,000, and the halo change by a factor of 2 or 3. Okay? That's actually quite important. Sorry, these are very important, you know, zeroth order predictions. We can make them a bit more precise, but for the slow discussion, it's not so important. This is one example of what happens if you do that. This is the halo mass now, galaxy mass, and this has been forced to match the luminosity function or the galaxy stellar mass function. Okay, you can see here how this becomes very steep at low halo masses. So steep that actually this will go down to masses that are, this is the mass of a globular cluster. Right? These are really faint galaxies. Below here, there are things that actually we can observe, but only very, very local universe. We'll talk about them later. But you see that, basically, think of this as having a sharp cutoff in mass. Masses below a certain, below say 10 to the 10, 10 to the 9, 9.5, don't form galaxies. If they did, they are so numerous, these halos, that would overpredict the number of dwarfs by huge amounts. Okay? So this is actually a very strong prediction of cold dark matter that is strong enough that we can actually hope to validate it or falsify it using observations. Okay? So think of this as this threshold and this idea that all dwarfs should have the first order. Yeah, I'm speaking very broadly here, the same halo mass.
So, okay? Quick question.
Yeah.
What is the curve there? How is that different from the point?
What is the line and the point?
Yeah.
This is just a simple matching that I said, just one-to-one. This is taking into account that some galaxies may have substructures, so they have halos inside of them. It should count them as well, and different variations of those. So this gives an idea, the difference between curves, points, and gives an idea of the uncertainty once you go to more detailed models. But regardless of that, the same conclusion, I think, applies. Perhaps not quantitatively, but definitely qualitatively. Actually, well, why this is happening in these models? This happens because of reionization. There's a reionization, cosmic reionization happened at a redshift of 10 or so. No, it happens. We can observe it. It did happen. Reionization heats the gas. Clumps that had not collapsed by then, and they were low mass, see their gas basically evaporate. The gas is now too hot to be kept within the low potential wells of these very low mass halos. And that's why you don't form galaxies in those halos. Yeah.
Paper was recently published in Nature, claiming that very distant galaxies came towards realizing the early formation of galaxies. a very steep decline.
Right.
And the dispersion velocity, rotation velocity. They claim that the fact they don't have top matter there.
Well, that's not my reading of the paper. What they measure is the systemic velocity of the stars, or actually the H-alpha, the H-2 regions, and they see that they declines. But they also see that the velocity dispersion actually increases quite dramatically. And so if you actually make a dynamical model of the two, the conclusion is that there is dark matter, more or less. It's just that the properties of the disks then were different than the properties of the disks today. Those disks seem to be hot and dominated not necessarily just by rotation, but by bulk motions of this of the star forming gas. So it's true that you have a declining rotation curve and still have dark matter, right? Depends on what the support of the gas of the gas is.
It's not significant.
Yeah, let me continue. We can discuss this, of course, at length later on. So now let me introduce now simulations. So now our simulations, that of course, not only do dark matter, but now also try to reproduce the formation of galaxies. And there's a big industry now happening. I'm part of this particular consortium. We did this kind of simulation called this the Eagle simulation series, where now you put all everything you can that you think you understand about physics, star formation, galaxy formation, and you try to see if whether you can reproduce, for example, things like the galaxy luminosity function. This has been quite a struggle for many years, but now the simulation system can converge to a point that we can actually produce stellar mass functions, you know, galaxy mass functions, which actually look very similar to the data, okay, using different prescriptions for how reionization is implemented, stellar feedback, etc. I want to get into the details of that if I could, but it will take me a bit away from that. The idea now is to use these same simulations that are being tested on this large scale, same prescriptions, and now apply them to much smaller scales, go to the scale of dwarfs. Okay. Because when you look at dwarf galaxies, there have been a number of puzzles that people have posed over the years, and they have different names, and there's a little bit of a moving field, but you know, you see a long list here. The missing satellites problem you may have heard of, too big to fail, satellite alignments, missing dark matter galaxies. All these, you know, each of them is kind of worth at least to take me a talk to go through. I'll try to go through three of these ones in some detail. Rotation curves of Kasper's score problem. People have been worried about this for a couple of decades at least. Another one that came more recently now, called the mass discrepancy acceleration relation. And this is even more recent, like from last year. I named this the cold feeble giant problem. I don't think it will ever catch, but it doesn't matter. At least you'll remember what I'm talking about. These are galaxies that are actually very large, and they apparently have very low velocity dispersions. We'll talk about them a bit more in a minute. Okay, so the other ones I could talk about, I think I did talk about many of them a couple of years ago, so let me not go into that. So, and what I'll use is a set of simulations that are the same as Eagle before, that I showed you before, but we call this a small sub-project of Eagle called Apostle. Apostle stands for a project of simulations of the local environment. It's a bit of a you know, strained acronym, as you can see, but since I walked El Camino de Santiago a couple of times now, and I found this that looks actually more just like me on the internet. If you put Apostle images, this is what comes up. And so I said, well, the acronym might stick. The idea here is that we apply the same codes, but to small volumes of the universe. Volumes that have been chosen to resemble the local group. In other words, to have two galaxies, two big galaxies like this. This is kind of a composite image. This over here shows the stars. This below the angle shows the stars in the simulation, and to the top shows the dark matter. You can see there are very few stars, lots of dark matter. And so there are two galaxies, and they are more or less the distance of M31, Andromeda, and us, approaching more or less the same velocity, etc. And the idea is that the local environment, which is actually where the only places where we can detect the faintest galaxies that we know, we can actually simulate. Right? So that's the one we use. It's also called Apostle because we try to recruit a 12th author, but if you count here, there are only 11. So we tried to get in 12, it didn't work. So nobody wanted to be the 12th apostle for reasons that if you remember your Sunday school, you might remember. But anyway, so, and also we have 12 different volumes. So this is based on 12 different realizations of the same, idea. So two galaxies, etc. Of course, quite different the ways of form, etc. Anyway, this is what it looks like. One of them, this is dark matter. This is the gas. These are the stars. Okay? And this is that composite that I mentioned. Okay, that sets the stage. Now I'll start talking about these problems that I mentioned. And the first one is this Kasper's score problem, or basically making sense of the rotation curves of dwarf galaxies. This has a long history, okay, and it's been going on since I started working on this topic quite a while ago now. And the idea is the following. You measure a rotation curve of a galaxy, measure the rotation speed as a function of distance from the center. This is rotation speed. And then you try to fit it with these halo models that we're talking about. First, you need to add to the model the contribution of the stars and the gas, or you need to subtract from the observations the contribution of the gas and stars, and in order to compare the predictions for dark matter. Okay, and this is more or less what it looks like. This is kind of a fit that has what people call a core. So instead of having this cusp that we mentioned at the beginning, the dark matter now is supposed to have a constant density region. Okay, so blue is with that core, and red is without it. Okay, of course, you know, the models have not been chosen to be normalized the same. And if you actually were to normalize this down a bit, the difference would be actually quite less remarkable. But it makes the point that the differences are not great to begin with, not large. Second, they mostly affect the inner regions where the velocities are low, rotation velocities are low. So any mistake that you make is going to be worse towards the center. And that's. So people, I think this has been a kind of an unfortunate state of affairs. I think I blame Max Planck for this. Remember Max Planck? Well, Planck said that, you know, if you can convince the older skeptical people, try to convince the young people, because the old will die and the young will survive. Therefore, the only ones that you should care about convincing are the young people. So a lot of people, young people, are convinced that this is a big problem, okay? And older people like me, who never thought this was a gigantic problem, were now basically sidelined by the power of youth. In any event, people take this actually quite seriously, this problem. And so seriously that now a lot of simulations, they've been kind of tuned in some way. Not tuned so it's the right way, but a lot of people have paid attention as to how dark matter may be changed by the formation of the galaxy. And in some models, not all, in some models, people find that you can change the dark matter. Baryons come from stars, then explode in supernovae, winds blow out, fan things. The potential varies, that varying potential can change the orbits of the dark matter. In some cases, increase their energy, migrate out, and lower the content of dark matter in the inner regions. This is an example from one paper, one simulation. So it goes from the open circles to the red. Okay, so the red was if you don't put the galaxy in, the open circles, you put the galaxy in, see it's gone down a little bit here. So that's and because now people see these cores, if you want, these lower densities of dark matter being produced in simulations, then simulations are like the internet. A lot of people think that simulations are like the internet. Oh, it's in a simulation, it must be true. Try that with the internet. Oh, it's in the internet, it must be true. It's not true, okay? So, simulations are simulations, okay? And you go to the Merriam-Webster or the Oxford Dictionary, you check. Simulation means to pretend, to deceive, to cajole, to confuse, all of those things, except to tell you the truth. So simulations are simulations. They are what are meant to be learning tools, not the final word. So anyway, this is what, but because of that, because observers think that these cores exist, and because now simulators also believe the cores exist, now the cores must exist, all right? I don't like that. I don't like those kinds of arguments. And also the way the problem is post is by basically, as I said, taking the data, subtracting the variance as best as you can, then to see what is left, and then trying to fit a power law to see if that the cusp is the same as was predicted in this in the other simulations. And because you know the cusp only happens in the inner regions here, this is usually quoted as slopes at 500 parsecs. Okay, I'm not making this up. You can see here, the slope of the dark matter at 500 parsecs. Now you go back if you want here, 500 parsecs is half of the one tick mark. There is no data at 500 parsecs, except for a couple of galaxies. This is crazy in my mind. But anyway, that is what it is. So in any way, but it's still interesting that rotation curves don't necessarily agree with the prediction of cold dark matter. So instead of focusing our attention on the inner parsec problem here, borrowing from a different field of astrophysics here, some analogy, what we should look at is the real prediction of cold dark matter. Cold dark matter predicts this similarity of profiles, this idea that if you tell me the velocity or the mass at one radius, I can predict everything. Let's use that instead of focusing on this, where the cusp is this way or that way. And that's what I tried to do with one of my students, and I'll be referring to most of his thesis work, Kyle Oman. He actually came from Waterloo. Is that right? Is anyone from Waterloo here? Waterloo?
Yes,
good. The Waterloo Masters came to work with us, and now he's going to Groningen on a postdoc, so we're very happy how well he's done. Anyway, so let's go back to this idea. Cold dark matter, you still predict this mass profiles or velocity profiles. Of course, when you put the baryons now, when you put the galaxies, this changed, right? Now you have more matter in the center. Baryons sink to the middle until they spin and become a disk. So there's more mass now than before. But presumably, the simulations reproduce that because you know we have similar disks and everything else that look very, very good. So, and this is the how they change. The top one goes from being this black, to this yellow. There's more mass, more high velocities in the inner regions. These are big galaxies, you see. This one's a bit more. And the dwarf ones, actually, the low mass galaxies, almost nothing. The reason for that is that dwarf galaxies are low surface brightness systems where the baryons basically never dominate. And that's why they're interesting. If you measure their dynamics, you actually measure their dark matter. There are so few stars that they make no difference to the total potential. But so the idea is that we can do this. This is to use the whole profile. When you do that, this is what you see. I'll show you a couple of examples. This one example is Homburg 2. That is a really dwarf galaxy, 30 kilometers per second maximum. Remember, our Milky Way is 220, way off scale here. So this is a very tiny galaxy in the local group called Homburg 2. And you see this is the measure rotation curve with some error bars. And this is what you predict naively just from a cold dark matter halo that has this maximum velocity, 35. This is the prediction, okay? And you, without doing any fancy statistics, you can see this has to be consistent from a statistics point of view. All right? Maybe over here you can make arguments that they're all 2 sigma below, etc. But
so what's going on with the error bars? These are very correlated. It looks like error bars are very correlated.
Yeah, this error bar is taken from the literature. I mean, this is not my data. Okay, it matters a lot, and I'll try to get into that.
What part of the galaxies in the top?
What's that?
Some
galaxies like this one.
What about those
in top? You're stealing my thunder here. Some do not. Okay? No, this, I'm just joking. Something else. This is another galaxy. We can do the same trick, okay? Now, this galaxy rotates much faster. It's a bigger galaxy, 70 kilometers per second, whatever, 80 kilometers per second. We'll do the same trick. 80 kilometers per second? Oh, done. 80 kilometers per second at 12 kiloparsecs, I have no freedom. Once I put this point here, I have only one curve to follow, this one. They say, well, the baryons have changed a little. Yeah, from the black to the gray or the gray to the black. Nothing. So this is inconsistent with the predictions of cold dark matter. It's not about 500 parsecs here. No, this is This is the problem, right? If you want to think of a Kasparov score problem, this is the problem you want to think about. And the way to think about this that I find more useful is that this galaxies like this one, if you take this data seriously, they show evidence for an inner deficit of dark matter. Something has happened to dark matter. If we live in a universe that's called dark matter, something happened to dark matter. It used to be here, you see? This is mostly dark matter to have dropped to this number. This is basically, you know, interior mass, of course, V squared times R. So this is really a measure of the mass inside each of these radii. So something has happened here, if we want to make sense of this. But that is the way to think about it. That's the way to think about the problem. Another way to think about the problem is think of, or maybe quantitatively now, is to plot the velocities of different galaxies at two different radii. Take the maximum, like in this case, and the velocity at 2 kiloparsecs. Arbitrarily, I could have taken 3, you could have taken 1, doesn't matter. 2 is just a good number because it's a radii that we can confidently simulate, and actually where most observations have reasonably good data, or at least the error bars quoted are relatively small. Okay, so plot this number, velocity here, at whatever the maximum happens to be, versus velocity at 2 kiloparsecs. And in cold dark matter, what you expect, of course, if you know the velocity anywhere, you know the velocity is everywhere, you expect a very tight correlation. This is what you expect. Velocity at 2 kiloparsecs here, velocity, maximum velocity here. This is the correlation you expect. And this is the prediction from cold dark matter. Okay, can we change a bit if you add the baryons? But you know they're all very tight. In other words, knowing the maximum velocity just tells you right away, what is the velocity everywhere? Circular velocity, the mass content. And this is what happens when you compare with data. These are just the best data available from a number of surveys, all of them 2D velocity fields. These are now just single slit rotation curves like people used to use in the past. This is the best data that we have. And you see, many, if not most, galaxies actually lie more or less in the prediction, but some don't. And one of the examples I showed before is one of the most egregious examples is that one here, for example. And this shows very clearly that within 2 kiloparsecs, these galaxies have less mass than you would predict. Can you make this with cores, with these cores in the simulations? The answer is no. These are the biggest cores that people have published from all this, you know, change in fluctuating the gravitational potential through star formation. They're nothing close to this. And the reason is, it's, I think, to me, very clear. I mean, this, in order to match a point like this one, you need to remove from the inner region of the galaxy like 10 times more than the baryons that you have there. Right? So not only to remove the baryons, you need to remove 10 times more than that by these funny moving potentials and star formation. That, I think, is very unlikely. So we need a different explanation if this is going to work. Okay. So we started doing the same now to Apostle. This is, again, work by Kyle. So an Apostle, these are Apostle galaxies. We have, of course, you know, very nice disks. And we apply now the same techniques that people use to derive the rotation curves for the observed galaxies to our galaxies. So we produce synthetic H1 data cubes, place them distance, add errors, etc. And observe them in the same way as we observe galaxies. As an example, these are real galaxies here to the right. These are simulated galaxies. We incline them like, at a given orbital inclination, project them, we measure things. And what people usually measure is the surface density profile of H1, a velocity map, line of sight velocity map. You see red and blue means the thing is spinning. Okay? And this is the velocity dispersion map. And these are similar things in the observations. Now they all look very, very similar. You can actually make many, with that many tests, are these, you know, reasonably comparable to things like observed in the same mass, at the same mass scale? And the answer is yes, I won't go into details. But let's look at these galaxies. Let's look at one of these. These are 3 galaxies, 3 examples. This is the actual circular velocity curve, the black. And the actual rotation of the gas, towards the mean azimuthal speed on the plane, this is without inclinations, without projections, nothing. You go to the plane, measure the mean azimuthal speed of the gas, compare with the rotation, with the circular velocity, the one that you have from the potential. And this galaxy looks pretty good, except maybe the leader parts are slightly declining. This one looks pretty good, except for a middle kink. This one actually doesn't look very good in the inner regions. Some of these galaxies are perturbed. Some of these galaxies have now created a satellite nearby. The gas is still not in equilibrium, so the mean rotation speed is not matched. But this one actually does. Okay, so these are actually how galaxies that don't appear very disturbed, actually don't appear disturbed at all. And everything else looks quite good. So, and actually, on top of that, the actual velocity of the gas, in this one in particular, is actually very faithfully, reproduces very faithfully the observation of the circular velocity curve.
So, do observers usually measure the gas velocity or a stellar velocity?
This gas, H1.
So we. This is
just H1. Yeah, of course we have stars, we have dark matter. This is just H1. Okay, so we take the H1 gas, and then we look at their azimuthal velocity. Now we'll take one example, take this example. You can see the azimuthal velocity and the circular velocity actually match very well. Okay.
Wait, you have actual H1?
Well, we have the density, we have the anisotropic background. We can, we actually compute the neutral hydrogen content of each of our gas particles, and we use that to do the weighting for all these things. Okay, so actually we use that to also make to project this, right? We take the H1 content. I mean, I didn't show it, but actually the H1 mass sizes, all those things are actually in very good agreement with typical galaxies. Yeah.
Back to the earlier simulations.
Right.
Is there a difference from the earlier results you showed compared to this?
The only difference is that we don't have any of those little cores, those changes here that I mentioned. So to us, the dark matter, and that's because we model star formation a different way.
Sorry.
So there is no, we have not, no, these models have no cores, if you want to think of them. So intrinsically, they have cuspy dark matter halos.
Is the success model dependent on what?
Well, it depends on how success is defined.
But
we're not fitting anything yet. This is just the gas going around in the potential well. Okay. In this case, the gas matches what you expect from a potential well. I can't compare it with anything yet. All right. So in this case, all we have is a system that has a gaseous disk that's spinning around. Its H1 content, or H1 gas, is going around more or less at the speed, on average, at each radius, at the speed that you expect it to be, if it's in centrifugal equilibrium.
No dark matter.
What's that?
These are just particles, gas. No dark matter.
Potential to the dark
matter. Of course, and these are these simulations. These are these galaxies. These galaxies I showed you. Right? These I showed the stars and a bit of the gas, but these are of course dark matter, and the whole. These are real models of. These are cold dark matter models of these galaxies, where we have all these components. Okay, so take that galaxy where the azimuthal speed was all very well, and we now project it. We incline it 60 degrees, we put it at 3 megaparsecs, we observe it with something like the VLA, and this is what you find. And then what you do is take two different orientations. Same inclination, but instead of looking like this, you do incline it, look like, and you rotate a bit, spin around at a different orientation. And you get either the red curve or the blue curve. Okay, and the errors of the method are given by this shaded area here. You see the differences in these two is much greater than the errors. So this galaxy where the gas actually is going around more or less in circular orbit, sorry, at the average speed of the circular orbit, its circular velocity measured by these models can vary quite dramatically, depending on how you look at it, or one orientation or a different one. So what is going on? Okay. And this is also true for this one. It's another galaxy. This is the other galaxy that actually was matching relatively well. You can see that it can be up, can be above, can be below. And the problem, of course, is the fact that these have non-circular motions. The gas has non-circular motions. In the case of this is the the case on the left where everything was very nice, you can see this is on the plane of the disk, the residual azimuthal velocity. The residual azimuthal velocity, red means you're spinning faster than the average, blue, lower than the average. I can see what happens. There is a clear M equal 2 mode, a bisymmetric flow of gas that has M equal 2, so of course 2 minima or 2 maxima, 2 red. So if you go around, you have always 2 maxima or 2 minima, and 2 minima. Okay, this is just taking one radius here, go around, you can see clearly it's a very clear M equal 2 mode in the velocity, M equal 2 mode modulation of the velocity. Same for this is the other galaxy, same thing happens to this one. The model that people use, most observers use, is blind to these bisymmetric flows. Can't see it because it's all based on tilted ring models. So you have rings that are, you tilt them, and then you change maybe the position angle of the ring, but the velocity is always the same around the ring. And what you do is try to arrange the inclination and the, of each ring and the speed so as to minimize the residuals. Okay, so see this in these plots here. These are from, well, it's inclination changes, functional radius, position angle changes. You add a velocity dispersion to the gas as well. So all those things are meant in the model to try and minimize the residuals. You actually do. If you do that, if you actually look at the residuals from the velocity map, these are actually the two different orientations. You can see the residuals actually quite small first, very comparable to what most galaxies have, and there is no residual that you identify at this M equal 2 mode. The problem with these bisymmetric flows, which is actually fairly well known, is that once you have a bisymmetric flow on the plane of the disk and you incline it, you have a cosine 2 phi mode, which and another cosine mode that comes from the inclination. So you have three cosines. So cosine 3 mode, you have three an m equal an m plus 1 if you want mode that gets generated by the projection. Actually an m equal m minus 1 mode as well. And the two get basically very difficult to detect. Even when the velocity can be as high as half the circular velocity, they're basically really difficult to detect.
Putting on these modes are supposed to be persistent, or
it depends. I mean, the easiest example of a mode that's persistent is a bar. If you have a bar, of course, there's a clear M equal 2 mode. So you go around, you encounter the bar once, twice, right? Every time. So you have, so the gas, what happens in the case of a bar? The gas will actually flow, go around, not in circles, but in ellipses, which is the same as this, right? So in that case, you have a persistent mode. Of course, if you just perturb it, just hit the galaxy with a hammer, it will react, it will accommodate, and of course, M equal 2 is, you know, the first mode after M equal 1, so it will always be higher than M equal 8, say. So you always have an, if there is a mode that is lurking around, M equal 2 will be important. So basically, the basic idea is that there are non-circular motions in these galaxies. And once you have non-circular motions, you cannot use the mean azimuthal velocity as a measure of mass. So as basic as that. You need a gas flow model. You need to know whether it's a stable, an equilibrium configuration like a bar or a triaxial potential, or something else. But you cannot use the mean azimuthal velocity. Mean azimuthal velocity does not tell you the inner mass. And it's as simple as that. I'll try to give you more examples now. This is two galaxies actually are very way off from the panel that I showed you before. So these outliers. These are two galaxies, actually, these are the model velocity fields, and these are the residuals. In this case, these are so deviant that the M equal 3 mode in the residual is pretty obvious. You can see the petal here, red, 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 blue, blue, blue. That's an M equal 3 mode, it's an M equal 2 mode in projection. The same thing here, 1, 2, 3 clumps of red, and of course, surrounded by 3 clumps of blue. So in the cases where the deviations are way off, this mode is actually very easy to see. And people know this, right? But what they recover is a mean azimuthal velocity that cannot be interpreted as a measure of the mass. Okay? And that is where the problem, I think, lies. Now, this is actually very Sorry, Gil, you were asking.
So is it only the ones that are way off the curve that show these big residuals, or do they all just not match?
They all show some degree of non-circularity in their motions. Now, the m equal 3, that clear, that obvious, it only happens to the ones that are really way off. Right? Because it can be hidden in many, many ways. Even in our own galaxies, if you actually do the best model fit and you subtract, you don't see the m equal 3 mode because it's been hidden by all the other parameters. Right?
Yeah. Is there any reason that the m equals 3 mode and these problems with the line of sight would show up in dwarf galaxies but not spiral galaxies? Because we have a lot of spiral galaxies.
Right. No, there are several reasons. One is that in dwarf galaxies, well, reasons that I think are important. I think in dwarf galaxies, what you have is, as I said, the dark matter halo naked. This doesn't add much to the potential. In big spirals, the contribution variance is much more important, like the Milky Way. Actually, Milky variance dominate in the inner regions. That has the effect of circularizing the potential. The dark matter knows this and circularizes itself. In dwarf galaxies, that doesn't happen. So because the barons don't dominate, the dark matter halos are triaxial, and they retain the triaxiality. And in that cold dark matter, another prediction, I didn't go into that, is that the triaxiality of the potential, the ellipticity of the potential, has to increase towards the center. So the m equal 2 modes should be there in almost every galaxy. How important, how big, it's all a question of a bit of a roll of the dice, but they should be there. Yeah.
Could all be like clusters. We use the Jay's equation.
Right.
Say isotropic and non-isotropic.
Right.
If you cut the dispersion laws. So what happens if you use these techniques here? It doesn't have, it doesn't have circular
function. Yeah, well, these are basically very similar techniques, right? So the Jeans equation with an azimuthal support, in which case all the other, you know, numbers actually vanish. So from the point of view of Jeans analysis, what we're adopting is using is the fact that in circular motion you have a well-defined relation between energy and angular momentum, which doesn't happen in a typical, you know, stellar system. Right, so that's what we're using here. No, I'm not saying no. It's just these are disk galaxies. You wouldn't apply the same kind of. Yeah, these are things that are going around, right?
Yeah.
Basically, in circles with slight perturbations. But it's the same. It's the same idea, right? Because what supports it in this case is not, you know, the velocity dispersion, but it's actually the coherent rotation, perturbed a bit by the velocity dispersion. Anyway, so these are the two galaxies I showed before. These are the galaxies that we have. If you project them at just random angles, right? You can see you can get similar deviations. So our next step on this is to just try to apply it, of course, to other galaxies that demonstrate this is really what's happening in most galaxies. And I think that, but the problem is actually quite, it's not trivial. Once you know the non-circular motions, as I was saying, then you cannot use the mean azimuthal velocity to tell you the inner mass. So you need a real gas fluid model for the whole disk to be able to drive the potential and then put constraints on the mass. And that's not what people do. People, the best they can do is hope to get an unbiased measure of the azimuthal velocity. Even if that were true, which is actually hard when you have no circular motions, that still is not what you want. Because that's not the inner mass, which is what we predict from cold dark matter. My feeling after doing all this work and being in this field for many years is that all of the Kasparov's core problem, all of it, is based on this. Non-circular motions that have been misinterpreted in the data. Yeah.
So you got your detailed models of these simulated galaxies.
Right.
You looked at a couple of different angles, but have you done a statistical analysis looking at lots of different angles to see what kind of distribution you end up with?
Yeah, we don't have, these are small volumes, you know, 2 or 3 megaparsecs on local group volumes. So we don't have an unbiased sample of all the galaxies of that mass. At the same time, none of the surveys that I showed you have that. They just picked the galaxies, basically cherry-picked, because they look nice, because they have a lot of H1, because They don't look, they're not merging with anything else. So it's very hard to do statistics when both the simulations and the observations have, you know, very distinct and very strong biases in the selection function. But it's something we could do.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Is it also possible that radial modes in addition to azimuthal modes?
Yes, well, actually, if you think of an ellipse, right, it is a radial mode plus an azimuthal mode. Just both is a sine, the other is a cosine. If you go through a bar, so right, you're at the major axis of the bar, you have zero both, but as you go in the minor axis, you're moving more slowly than faster azimuthally, but also radially. So you have to move in. Think of an ellipse, right? An ellipse, when you go from towards the other axis, you go actually in, right? You're going inwards. And so you have a radial velocity. So the two actually are a couple together.
Okay, so can I think of a pure azimuthal mode as a sum of two ellipses?
You can, and that's called the epicycle approximation. That works when you can think of an ellipse as the sum of a circle plus an ellipse that goes the other way around, like, you know, in the Kepler problem, that's, you can do that. That, unfortunately, doesn't work anymore when the deviations are large. But it's good to build intuition. All right. That was one of the three things I wanted to tell you. But that's a good one. That's a good a bit. So let me just see if I can finish telling you a little bit about this, just because it's kind of new and more, I'm not sure, more fun, but new. So allow me to go until 12 then. And it's going back to, so it's what we call mass discrepancy acceleration and this extremely cold dwarfs, okay? So remember this. Okay, this is mass now, and this is the stellar mass of the halo, and this is the mass of galaxies. Remember, as I told you, below a certain mass, you shouldn't have any galaxies. So these are the actual results from the simulation, our simulations. Okay. And you can see this actually works quite well. There are a few stragglers over here. Those we understand. Those galaxies actually have lost mass because they've gone through a halo and come out on the other side. And then now they're identified as isolated objects, but they're really neighbors of a bigger galaxy. But you can see how well this cutoff that I mentioned works. Below a certain mass, you don't have any galaxies. And at a given, at least isolated galaxies. And for all this, from 10^4 to 10^8, all these galaxies basically have the same halo. The velocity is the mass of the halo, same mass of the halo, halos of the same mass. So enter this galaxy, called Crater 2, was recently discovered a year and a half ago, I believe, and it's huge. Okay, this is huge in the sky. I took this from their Scan telescope or whatever press release. It's actually bigger than the full moon, so it's huge. That's why it's easy to, it's very nearby, it's 100 kiloparsecs away, but it's actually quite, and it's actually very, very faint. This is the luminosity of Draco, if you know your dwarf spherules, but it's much, much bigger, huge. It's 10 times bigger than Draco. And this is what it looked like if it was, you know, made 1,000 times more luminous, just for the scale.
I mean, Is it very state?
Yes, I mean, we believe all these things have velocity expressions which are crossing times, which are very, very short compared to the age of the universe. So, and therefore, the world, and unless they're really in the process of being disturbed, they are actually very close to equilibrium. So anyway, this, as I said, the size for that luminosity and its velocity expression, which are very low actually, are both unusual for a galaxy of this luminosity. Okay, in this plot that I showed before, this is velocity here. Remember, the velocity can actually measure. We measure velocity dispersion, and some velocity dispersion of the circular velocity, and this is where it would like, a few times 10^5 and 3 or 4 kilometers per second, way off this prediction. So what's happened? How do you get galaxies there? And that's what I'll try to do in the next 4 or 5 minutes. And to put in context with this other thing, which is the mass discrepancy acceleration. Okay, so hold that second, hold it for a minute. This is mass discrepancy acceleration. So what people did here in the paper that was written by Stacey McGoffin, collaborators here on PRL recently, and people from the physics community especially got a lot of attention. I guess people from physics read PRL, that don't read UpJ, and we do the opposite. So sometimes it's good to publish, to cross-publish, I guess. So anyway, this is the idea. You have a rotation velocity, rotation curve versus radius. This is the black curve here. You can predict what would be rotation if you only had the baryons, the gas and stars, okay? And that would be the blue, okay? And this for three galaxies, different masses in this case. And what they've been arguing for quite a while, actually, is that you can predict this rotation velocities from these rotation velocities using a very simple conversion. Clearly, they're not the same. It clearly depends on velocity, but they can do the same. So what they do is they plot, instead of velocity versus radius, they plot an acceleration. In other words, they plot b squared divided by r. So b, think of this, b squared divided by r. And you plot it versus v squared divided by r, or the blue one. V squared divided by r, this, and then it looks like a curve like that. This is a one-to-one curve, looks like that. The interesting thing, that's, say, well, who cares? The interesting thing comes when you do this for other galaxies, less massive, these are less massive galaxies. You do the same, and they seem to lie on extensions of the same kind of relation. This, like, this was the same as that one, you add this one, then this low mass galaxy adds a little bit at the end. And there's kind of a relation, and then if you actually do this for many, many galaxies, you do this for many, many radii, many, many velocities, they all seem to lie on top of a single relation, the two. Okay, like that. So where did that come from? Okay. And the reason I got interested in this was twofold. Actually, one was a journalist called me and asked me, why, what do you think of this paper? I hadn't read it, so I actually read it, like, because I had to respond something. Then because Crater 2, this crazy galaxy we talked about, would lie on this extrapolation from this data to much brighter galaxies over here, but not too far. Right, from the same relation. So what is going on? How do we make sense of this?
But is that point that there's also a cluster?
This is Crater 2.
No, the other one, right?
Oh, this is just the error bar, some measure of the...
It's not a reality.
No, it's not real. It's an estimate of the error, or the RMS, I forget what it is. Anyway, so where does this come from in Lambda CDM? Lambda CDM actually comes from these cuspy profiles, as I'll show you in a minute. So take galaxies, halo mass, stellar mass, the galaxies in cold dark matter have to live in particular places, right? This is the abundance matching curve that I showed you before. Take five galaxies on the abundance matching, give them sizes so they are consistent with the empirical mass size relation, okay? And then plot them on this relation. Of course, they're exactly on top of this. Actually, I chose them so that they'll be exactly on top of that. So in other words, the characteristic acceleration of galaxies, because they satisfy these scaling relations, because as you go more massive, you get higher surface brightness, and you live in more massive halos, you naturally reproduce the main trend. And this is just one point per galaxy. Okay? The reason why they line up on top of each other, on top of that, comes from the fact that the cuspy dark matter halo, plotted as an acceleration, a cuspy dark matter halo is actually a region of the center, is a region of constant acceleration. V squared over r is a constant. This is here, right? The center, they're constant. Because they're constant in dwarfs, when you put a galaxy and you measure the velocity, the acceleration at different radii, you always get the same number. So you get something that's quite flat here in dwarfs. In massive galaxies, the baryons dominate. So you get a one-to-one, right? Baryons dominate, the acceleration, you plot the acceleration of the baryons versus the total, you're plotting one versus one. So you're over here in the one-to-one regime. And all the other ones are intermediates. Okay? And the shape of this, actually, in radius, looks very much like that line. You can see that here, these are just NFW, cold dark matter halo plus a little exponential disk predictions. So there is no secret to this. This is a result of the subsimilarity of cold dark matter plus the fact that there are well-defined scaling relations between size and mass of galaxies. Yeah, this actually matches very well that as well. There's no problem. Right?
But I mean, you're measuring these things and putting them in, so that's not really a prediction. That's so you're saying data is consistent with data. So
no. I mean, these gray points over here are the results of the simulation themselves, right? So if you want to look at them,
are from the simulation.
Those are from Eagle and Apollo all together. So those are not meant to do that. And the reason why they don't fit exactly is because the simulations don't fit exactly these relations, right? So the simulations are not perfect. The simulations were actually reproduced abundance matching, and the observed sizes, we actually match that exactly well, perfectly well. Actually, it's reassuring that we don't match it because we don't match this, and we shouldn't match that one either. Right. And now let me just finish trying to see if I can wrap this up with crater 2. Okay, this is what this looks like. This is now a bigger axis here. I'm putting crater 2. This is the prediction from galaxies from our simulations. All right, we have only one point per galaxy now because in the spiral galaxy we can only measure mass in one radius. Okay? We do the same here. You see, we predict this constant because this constant comes from the fact that there is this cutoff in mass. It cannot go below this. So, but here's crater 2. What happens? What happens is that there are tides. These are satellites of the Milky Way. Tides can lead to the loss of dark matter, but not a loss of stars. So you start eroding this. This minimum only applies to galaxies that have not been, or halos that have not been stripped.
So the tide is stripping back to my original question. Just significant deviations due to lack of it's not
very. Yeah, the disruptions in this case the orbits of these things are usually very elliptical. Okay, so the tide actually operates almost as an impulse. So that's why it hits. So basically, it's like the galaxy gets hit at the pericenter, but it spends most of its time upper center, where it has tons of time to re-equilibrate. So in the simulation, although of course you only find someone who's going through some perturbation, most things, even the ones that have been very heavily stripped, are very near equilibrium because they're upper centers, right? And the crossing times are much shorter than the orbital times. Anyway, so this is this is where these galaxies are. Let me skip a bit so I can finish here. But the idea is that these are stripped objects. And just to make sense of that, let me go back to the idea that all the dwarfs should have the same halo mass. If they have the same halo mass, then their velocities should scale with radius, just like the mass profile of a cold dark matter, which is we're basically measuring the mass at different radii of the same halo. So all the velocities should be on this gray line for all the dwarfs. You see, they're not. Many of them are below. And these are actually the ones that we assume to be stripped. Now, let me assume that they were stripped. First of all, because there's no other way we can make sense of this in cold dark matter. And these are very low velocity dispersions. But the only way they can get here and form in our models is by stripping them. If they've been stripped, actually we know a bit more. If you strip things in cold dark matter halos, galaxies, then there are well-defined tracks where the stripping must take you. You cannot strip mass and not change the radius. You cannot change the radius and not change the velocity dispersion. And we know how these things work. So we can unstrip them. Sorry, clothe them. So we can bring them back to where they should have been. Okay? By fact, right? I'm doing this as an exercise. So this galaxy was here, actually came from a galaxy that was here, a progenitor here. And these X's mean factors of 10 in mass loss. So this extremely stripped galaxies here are basically the result of almost two decades of mass loss. We're seeing today the remnant crater 2 in this picture is the 1% remnant of a much bigger galaxy. One way to convince ourselves this is not completely crazy is by looking at the radii. Stripping in these halos, it'll take me too long to explain exactly why, happens at almost a constant radius. You strip a galaxy, you change its velocity spurge, you change its luminosity, its stellar mass, but its radius doesn't change very much. You see, this is two orders of magnitude here, factor of five here, and almost nothing in radius. These are vertical lines almost. If you change the velocities this way, this is what they look like in a mass size relation. This is what the progenitors look like. You see, all these blue ones tend to be below the typical galaxy of that size, much less luminous than they are. If you correct them this way, and this is by fact, this is a result of the model, they all align with each other. So in other words, these unstripped galaxies look very much like the field galaxies of those sizes. So the reason why Creator 2 is that big is because it was once much more massive, and today it's been stripped to almost nothing. And that should make sense of also velocity dispersions. This is what the velocity dispersion metallicity looked like without this correction. This is with the correction. Before, there's this almost the thing's flat now. So many galaxies of the same metallicity, they have very different velocity dispersion. When you include a correction, they all look very similar. So going back to Creator 2 then, the idea for Creator 2 is that this Creator 2 is a galaxy over here, and actually many more like that, no, it's not alone, are things that were over here that have been stripped down to here. The prediction of this model is also that this is an extreme case. There are many that shouldn't be very extreme and others that shouldn't be stripped at all, right? So there should be a very large scatter at this. They all start over here on this line and they get stripped down. So the prediction from cold dark matter is that there shouldn't be a relation once you include satellites in your samples. There shouldn't be a relation anymore between these things. And this is actually what you observe from here. There is no relation. The scatter at these low accelerations is, as you can see, huge. Anyway, let me finish there. So I went way over my time, so I appreciate your patience. Thanks.
Problem of gravity. So we seem to have a situation which mirrors the politics of sort of the Canadian border. We have two alternate realities. And one reality says that God may have exists, even though we have not yet detected it as a particle.
Mm-hmm.
The other one says, well, gravity is a problem, modified gravity. And you offer a lot of these modified gravity. And the problem is it's very difficult to get data, the silver bullet data, which really tells you which reality is correct and which is false.
Well, I mean.
No, I'm not. By the way, this model I have. So, what is the data that you find at the site?
Well, I mean, I guess we cannot rule out every theory that's around, but I think we can rule out some theories that are around, provided they make predictions that are testable. The one theory that comes to mind is MOND, modified Newtonian gravity. That doesn't work for many reasons. So things like that, I think, are untenable. Right? Others that are a bit more convoluted, or where the predictions are a bit less more vague, are of course going to be much harder to rule out, including cold dark matter. I mean, cold dark matter is, after all, we have a model for the dark matter actually very well defined. But you know how we interface with the real observations of what is really a baryonic component is, as I was saying in my whole talk, is quite complicated, right? We observe what we can observe, and then we infer. We make a model. And in that modeling, there's a lot of you know, uncertainties that get introduced or simplifications that that are sometimes not very well understood. And I think we need to be open-minded, like in everything else in science, and see how far we can go with any of the theories. But I guess that's a general statement for science, not for this problem in particular. Anything else? All right, thanks.